Our star guest today is a television and radio presenter, an actor, and a bit of a foodie. He's best remembered probably as being one of Esther's boys on That's Life, but we know him better as Bill Buckley. Bill, welcome to Read on the Radio and Community Connections.
Thank you very much. Very pleased to be here.
Now, you have done a lot, but has that Esther's boy motif followed you around a bit?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it was such a long time ago. We're talking the mid-80s, that when people kind of realise they vaguely know me from somewhere these days, it might be about that, or it might be about one of the numerous radio stations that I've worked on, or it might be from doing 6.5 years of continuity announcing at Channel 5, or what else might it be? There's more than that, but there's all these. There was a time when it was always that, and now it can be lots of different things, and that's really very nice.
Your career started way back before 1982. You were a journalist, weren't you, in the West Midlands?
Yeah, I knew very much that I wanted to, well, show off for money, really, in whatever way was available to me for a living. So I'd kind of sensed from watching the television and listening to the radio, and, you know, from a very early age, and other people you'll have spoken to, I imagine, will have told you this, or if you ever asked them, would tell you this. Watching television, listening to radio in a completely analytical, different, concentrating way that normal people don't do, because what I really wanted to fathom out was how to get through this. Where was this magical door, and how did you unlock it to get into this life that I sort of decided from the age of about 6 or 7 was going to be the life for me? So at school, I did all the subjects that I thought might lead me to a career either in acting or journalism, because it seemed, from what I could see from the telly box and the radio, that people generally had previously been actors or journalists. And I kind of thought, well, journalism's a bit safer and a bit more secure, and if I don't ever make it, maybe I'll have an okay life as a hack. So I did all my subjects at school, and then I applied. Well, actually, I was going to apply at the age of 18 to join one of the newspaper groups in the West Midlands where I grew up. But the trouble was, you see, I was at the grammar school and I was in the top stream, and our careers master didn't say, so will you be going to university? Our careers master said, which universities will you be applying to? And I told him that I wasn't going to apply to university. I was going to apply to the Birmingham Post and Mail Group and the Midland News Association Group, which included the Express and Star in Wolverhampton, and see if I could get taken on as a trainee. And the blood drained from his face as he realised that one of his safe bets for a university place, which would make him look very good and would look the stats look very good when they were published in the Sutton Coldfield News, was kind of going out the window. And he persuaded me to go and read English at Birmingham University, and music as well I did. But I only stayed a term, and I knew it wasn't for me, so I left. And I rang up the Midland News Association and said, I know you only normally take people at the age of 21 with an English degree. Would you ever consider taking a 19-year-old with just A-levels? And they said, we don't know what you're talking about. We recruit at 18 and you need an English A-level and one other. So then I applied for that and I got in and I did my indentures, as they were quaintly called. And then, I mean, I was very naughty to the Express and Star, really, because they invested all that money and time in me and got me through my exams. And as soon as I was through them, I was trying to move off and go elsewhere. And I applied for a radio job. And the very first thing I applied for, and they wanted me, but it was a new station, BBC Radio Northampton. And they said, we're opening very shortly. You need to come kind of like now. And I had to give a month's notice, and the Express and Star wouldn't let me go, which was a terrible situation because I was then stuck there and they knew I didn't want to be. So that was pretty horrendous. But the very second job, which I applied for and which I didn't eat, well, actually, I didn't apply for. I was away on holiday and my mother kindly applied on my behalf without contacting me, because it was quite difficult in those days to, you know, make international phone calls, was That's Life. So applied for two and got two, basically. And I was a little bit glad, really, no offence to BBC Radio Northampton, but I was kind of a little bit glad that the second one, That's Life, was doable. And the funny thing was, that whereas they would not let me leave a day early to go to this newfangled local radio station, as soon as my bosses heard what it was, I could have left any time I wanted. They were so thrilled to like bask in the reflected glory, as it were, of one of their little cubs going off to do network telly, that they were very helpful in setting me up with leaving.
So your career then jumped from local journalism to national television without anything locally broadcastable in the middle, as it were.
Oh yes, it was absolutely, bizarre looking back on it. Yeah, and I mean, there are those who said I've been like peddling backwards ever since, really, because the audiences in those days were routinely 15 million, sometimes 20 million people watching. And a few weeks before, I'd been scribbling away in the magistrate's court, taking the case down, or going round to a council flat to investigate their damp problem for a page five filler in the Express and Star. And suddenly there I am on a Sunday night, strolling onto the in front of the audience, onto the set in the Shepherd's Bush Theatre, where just about every legendary television show came from while I was growing up. It was indeed very, very heady stuff for a young lad from Birmingham.
You were a team, though, weren't you? Particularly the three on the desk at the back, I seem to recall very vividly. How did you and Esther and Doc get on?
Yeah, well, Doc was over the other side because Doc did the funnies. Doc took over with an actress called Joanna Monroe from Cyril Fletcher, who for many years had done the funnies. But they were doing the funnies, and my panel was Gavin Campbell and a gentleman called Michael Groth, who I'm still great friends with, actually. We had lunch about 3 weeks ago. And well, we got on very well, but it was all hands to the pump. I mean, there was about 20 of us working on the programme. We were presenters, but also researchers and reporters. And then there were lots of people who were full-time researchers. And there were a couple of secretaries and a production assistant and all that kind of thing. Most of us incredibly inexperienced. Esther, of course, had done the show for years. Our editor was very experienced, so he hadn't presented That's Life until he started at the same time as me. But somehow, with Esther kind of trying to hang on to all these overexcited young puppies wanting to do these exciting things, we somehow managed to make it. But there was a real, it was more like a team effort because we were all clinging together in terror, probably more than anything else. Because come Sunday night, you had to have 45 minutes worth of high quality, engaging entertainment. And you started the week on the, and it didn't start the week till the Tuesday because we worked on the Sunday. So you didn't start till the Tuesday morning at 9:30 with nothing, with a blank canvas. And we worked long hours, we worked very hard. If your story fell down on a Thursday night, which they often did, because the baddies would now know, because you had to ask the baddies for their side of the story, so they knew that they were going to be done. So they would suddenly become angels and go round and sort out Mrs. Doodah's problem, and you hadn't got a story anymore, and you've got to find another one and get it done in time for the scripting on a Friday evening. So yeah, we were a lovely team, partly because we had to be, but partly because they were very nice people anyway.
The programme itself was part watchdog, part entertainment, part music, part comedy, and yet it all blended into a complete programme that transcended all of them individually.
Well, yes, I like to think it did. And if we used to laugh about it and say, if That's Life didn't exist, and if Braden's Week and Braden's Beat before it hadn't existed, and you bowled up to the controller of BBC One and you said, I've got this great idea for a programme. First of all, we'll have a parsnip that looks like male genitalia. Then we'll have a story about babies dying unnecessarily because of some silly rule, blah, blah. And then we'll go straight back from there into a dog that can walk on one leg. You would have been laughed out of that office. But because it had evolved gradually, if you look at very early That's Life, they weren't really much like That's Life by the time that I was on it. So because it was this very slow, gradual evolution, the public, bless them, just accepted this as a normal shape for a television programme. And that weirdness, I think, was its greatest strength of all. That's why it did work.
Also, being on that Sunday evening spot, I know as a child that the end theme tune was always the sign for me to tell me the weekend was over, it was school the next day. But it was back in the day where, even at that time of night, families would sit round, wouldn't they? And that might be the treat that you were allowed to stay up for before you went to school the next day.
Yeah, I have been told that by many, many people, and they say not only therefore do they have very fond memories of it, but if they do think about it or hear the music or whatever, that also there's a great feeling of sadness over them because they've got to go back and do double maths in the morning. So it's like a bittersweet memory for millions of people. And yes, if you're, I suppose if you're anything, actually up to quite a great age because it started back. I mean, I remember certainly as a teenager watching it, and then it went on for another more than 10 years after I left it. So there's this huge swathe of people who, for whom it is a little bit of their, you know, in their hearts and in their minds. And that makes it very nice to have been a part of, yeah.
We have the theme tune following this interview, so that'll bring back a few memories for people, I'm sure. Bill, let's move on from That's Life. And you're, as you've said, almost pedalling backwards, but coming back to the world of local radio. But for you, local was actually all over the place, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I was very lucky to move on to the BBC's holiday programme, and I had six wonderful, the one that used to be called Holiday 82, 83, 84, etc. So I had 6 great years working on that and saw the world and loved writing the commentaries to go with the pictures. It was my possibly my favourite work ever. But the problem with it was that you were only required for maybe 8 or 10 weeks in total of the year. So there wasn't a lot of money in it. And I did need to find a more steady income, having given up my very regular That's Life income. And by luckily, I went down to BBC South in Southampton to make a documentary, a regional documentary about the hurricane and the effects of it. And I think it was I don't know which way round it was, but BBC Television was on one floor of a building down there, and BBC Radio Solent was on either the floor above or the floor below. And I'd got nothing to do for about half an hour. We were waiting for some edited film to come through to write the commentary to. So I went up and I spoke to the receptionist, and I got in and I saw the guy in charge, and I said, "If you need anybody to do any cover work, I'm your man." And he said, he said, "Yes. Have you any idea what we pay in local radio?" And I said, "No, but I imagine not very much." And he said, "Two right is not very much. Would you care to tell me why somebody from network television would want to come schlep all this way down and hardly earn any money?" But I managed to convince him that that was where my heart was. And I started doing cover work, and they gave me a full-time gig. And I was there for 3 years. And then I was poached by the local commercial opposition, shock horror. South Coast Radio was the name of the station, and I did 4 years there, and that was really good training because the priorities of BBC and commercial radio were so different. So I kind of learned the other half of how you do it from them, and then I jumped right from them to, you know, LBC, big station in London, and I had 2 long spells actually at LBC. Trouble with LBC was that it kept getting bought out by other people. Everybody kept being sacked. So I was there having a lovely, jolly time, and it got sold, and everybody got sacked, including me. And then a bit later on, somebody else bought it, and they liked me, and they headhunted me, and I went back. And then he got sold out, and then I was off again. They're wonderful days at LBC, and I've worked at many other stations, BBC Southern Counties, which was Sussex and Surrey, was my longest ever spell. I think that was about 9 years. I had 3 wonderful years down in Devon, down in Plymouth. So I've just followed wherever the work was, really, and have pretty much. I've always liked to have radio as the core product, and then little bits of like the cherries and the icing on the cake being telly or theatre or pantomime or, you know, that things like that. But radio is the core, and I am a radio man through and through.
Radio Devon is my old stomping ground from more years ago than I care to remember, Bill. I don't think our paths
All
ever
right.
crossed in Plymouth or Exeter. Food is something else that you're very well remembered for. Particularly, you did rather well on Come Dine With Me.
Well, yes, that was, gosh, a long time ago now, and there it was before that program had been on the television, and I got a phone call, or was it an email, an early email, saying, "Would you be interested in taking part in this?" And so I said, "Yes, I would." And I wasn't sure whether it was like a celebrity thing or just an anybody thing. And it turned out to be an anybody thing. And off we went, and the five of us, and we'd no idea that there was going to be a very funny, sarcastic commentary. We didn't know what the program was going to look like. And all the five of us had been found in different ways because nobody was applying for the program because nobody knew the program existed. So did that, and probably more by luck than judgment, it happened to turn out very well for me. It looked like on the program I was a nice, reasonable person, and it looked like I could cook and host quite well, and I did win my week, despite some skullduggery from some of the others, even in those early days. And then it kept getting shown like over and over again. First of all, on Channel 4 it was repeated, then on E4, and then on More4, and then on more and more minor channels. But it went on for years and years. So thank goodness it did turn out well for me. And years after I'd forgotten all about it, I'd be on a bus, and somebody would say, I know you off the telly. And I'd be expecting them to say, that's life. And they'd say, oh, I loved how you cooked that fish on Come Dine With Me. What did you do again with it? And all of that. So that was a very good week for me. Oh, and the way they found me, incidentally, by the way, was they said, oh, Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares gave us their database. And I said, I've never auditioned for Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares. I said, yes, you did. You auditioned on the so-and-so date of whatever. And I'd gone along to a program that was looking for either chefs with personality or celebrities who could cook. But we weren't told what it was. And of course, in the end on the telly, it was all celebrities, wasn't it? With him screaming at them. But therefore, I didn't make the connection. But that's what I'd auditioned for and not got. But they had passed me on to Come Dine With Me. And that is how this weird entertainment business works, which is why so many people in show business are nervous wrecks or alcoholics, because it's all completely out of your hands and beyond your control. And you're just a leaf blowing in the wind and hoping you land somewhere that you can get the next job and make a living.
And are you still cooking at home?
Absolutely, yeah. We just had lovely guests for the weekend, and we did a four-course dinner on the Friday, on the Saturday night, and we did a roast followed by my rather fine, if I say so myself, ginger steamed sponge pudding on the Sunday with the ginger custard. Oh yes, I'm still cooking.
Well, that's making me feel very hungry, I can tell you, Bill. What are you doing apart from cooking? What's in the Bill Buckley diary at the moment?
Well, work-wise, these days I'm really more about food than anything else. I've been a judge for the Great Taste Awards. If you go into the supermarket these days and you see products with a little black label with either one, two, or if it's really exceptional, three gold stars on it, those are the Great Taste Awards. And I was asked about 15 years ago to join them as a judge. I think because I was already a member of the Guild of Food Writers, because by then I'd done a lot of broadcasting, radio and television, about food, and a smaller amount, but nonetheless quite a bit of food journalism in print as well. So I got into the Guild of Food Writers, and that led, which I'm still in, and that led to the Great Taste Awards. So I've been doing that for the last 15 years, and now that I'm not doing a regular radio show, I've actually got much more time to devote to that, and I love it. Also, for nearly as long, I've been a judge and coordinator for the Academy of Chocolate Awards, and that's just about to kick off for this year now. So any day now, a great big parcel will arrive from the postman, and that will be about 100 or 150 bars of chocolate from all over the world. And I will plough through maybe about 10 an evening at home and write my report on every single one of them and give every single one of them a rating. And then we also meet at a college in the centre of London to judge the chocolates that don't survive very well in the post. So, like soft centre filled chocolates and things like that that you can't really send through the post. So, I do a lot of that work. And I do quite a lot of work for literary festivals, especially the Henley Literary Festival, interviewing authors in front of live audiences. I've got John Cleese coming up fairly soon for that, which will be very interesting and challenging, I think. And I still do some food demoing and hosting as well at food festivals like the Didcot Food Festival. I've presented that for quite a few years. So I've not by entirely by accident, not by design at all, I have moved more into the food area and the literary area, but still kind of from a broadcasting starting point. And that's where I am now.
It's been absolutely wonderful chatting to you, Bill. May we wish you all the best, particularly in that chocolate tasting hardship that you have to go through. I'm sure my partner would be quite happy for me to pass you on her details should you need any help.
Well, would you be kind enough to tell your partner that by the time you are tasting sample number 51 at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you would rather be doing anything in this world than eating chocolate, and you still have to keep a clear, objective head and do the job and write out your report. So it's not quite like people think it is, but obviously I wouldn't do it if I didn't like it. So she's half right.
Bill Buckley, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme. Keep in touch with us because you have so much going on in your life. We'd love to have you back on sometime.
No problem, any old time. Good to talk to you too.
Thank you.